Out at the football, so watching the Gales play. So I'm sure there's tickets available, and come and hang out with us there. And if you're not into that and you want to go,
if you're a woman entrepreneur, go come and see me at St. Lawrence College.
Yeah, and go to AWEC.
Yes. All right. And go Jays, go.
Yeah.
Ogden Scare.
If you ever plan to motor west, travel my way, take that highway, that's the best.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
Greetings, friends. My name is Jessa McLean, and I'm here to provide you with some blueprints of disruption. This weekly podcast is dedicated to amplifying the work of activists, examining power structures, and sharing the success stories from the grassroots.
Good morning, Dimitri. Is it even morning there?
It's almost 5 in the evening, but that was introduction got me all riled up.
Good. That was our rabble rants intro that went on, just glitched out on us there. So, yeah, it woke me up. But happy to have you in the studio again, Dimitri. I believe it's your third time, but I'll link all your previous appearances in the show notes for folks. I saw your tweet come across my feed, or maybe it was Instagram, and you were up to some shenanigans. We wanted to talk to you about it. Good shenanigans, all good trouble. And do you want to tell us a little bit about your latest lawsuit? People forget maybe you're also a lawyer and a shit disturber, right? An activist. They see you on YouTube as well, but you do practice law and you're at it again. Tell us about TMU.
Well, if you can't disturb the shit once in a while with the legal mechanisms available to us, then what is the whole point of the legal system?
Yeah, why did you go to school?
Exactly. So the short answer to your question, Jessa, is that we have filed a myself and four other lawyers, it's five of us, from various backgrounds who have agreed to represent 10 current and former students at Toronto Metropolitan University on a pro bono basis in a lawsuit filed last week against the university. These students and former students were all, were or are enrolled at the Lincoln Alexander School of Law at Toronto Metropolitan University. And the short explanation of why we sued is that the university smeared them for approximately 2 years as anti-Semites, and did so even after they were cleared of the accusation of anti-Semitism by a retired Chief Justice of Nova Scotia, whom they hired to conduct an external review. It was the judge of their choice cleared them, and they continued, over the objections of the students who signed the letter in support of Palestinians, to smear them up until the day that we filed our lawsuit, when they suddenly retracted the defamatory statement from the university's website without even having the courtesy to notify us that they were retracting it.
I was going to ask you, you know, I saw an article in Toronto today. I was reading it, clicked on the link to see, oh, the statement is still up. And sure enough, you know, website cannot be found. So a little bit of movement from the university, but they retracted it, but not really. Like, they just quietly broke the link, right? And there was no admitting of wrongdoing or any clarification put out there. And they were fucking explicit, right? They said there's a letter, right? You did say it was a short answer, so I'll give a few more details. You could take a break. But, like, students signed a letter, and I'm not going to read it. I'll link it for folks. 75 students. Most of them were anonymous. A lot of folks did put their name to it. But it wasn't, like, a real radical statement. I mean, it was well-worded, but it made some acknowledgments. It was nowhere near anti-Semitic. And the university said it contained sentiments of anti-Semitism and intolerance. Like, that's so explicit to put that out in a public statement. It's one thing, like, we get these quips online all the time. Like, how many times a day are we, like, those accusations thrown at Palestinian solidarity activists? But to have an university administrator put that out publicly, did they not expect somebody would come back and sue them for it?
No, they punch down. That's what these people do. You know, they go after people who don't have the financial capacity to defend their rights in a court of law. And the only reason why these students can is because they found five lawyers who are willing to represent them pro bono. These are students who, you know, we, as I'm sure you know, Jess and Santiago, you know, nowadays to get a university education and especially to go all the way to the end of law school, 7 years of university education, you're going to have to spend a ton of money and you're probably going to end up with a lot of debt. And you're in no position to hire some capable lawyer to represent you in a court of law. And the university understands this. And they thought that these students were just going to, you know, lie down and take the beating. And they turned out to be sorely mistaken. Now, there's a really important, I don't know if you recall this, Jessa, but there was a huge controversy surrounding the signing of this letter back in late 2023. And it really is important to understand the context here to appreciate just how appalling the behavior of the university is. So when this letter was signed, it was October 20th, 2023. So this was almost 2 weeks after the attacks of October 7th. By that point in time, even within 2 weeks, Israel had massacred thousands of Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip, and far more than Palestinian militants were alleged to have killed on October 7th. The number that the Israelis gave is approximately 800 civilians were killed on that day. Not all of them Israelis, by the way. And there is a serious question about who actually killed all those people. Some were killed by Palestinian militants, but there's a lot of evidence that the Israeli military implemented something called the Hannibal Directive and started just firing wildly to prevent any Israelis from being taken back into Gaza as hostages. There's plenty of evidence that a number of those people were killed by Israeli soldiers. But let's say the number is 800, just for the purposes of argument. Palestinian militants killed them all. By the time you get to October 20th, there had been several thousand Palestinian civilians killed. And not only that, but Israel's most senior leaders had made openly genocidal statements, like President Herzog, Prime Minister Netanyahu, the former defense minister, Yoav Gallant. And you don't have to take my word for it that their statements were genocidal. You just have to look at the decision of the International Court of Justice in January 2024, when it said that it was plausible Israel was committing genocide. The court cited the statements that were made in that period between October 7th and October 20th as evidence of Israel's genocidal intent. So our clients, reacting to this, said there's a genocide unfolding, and the law school is making noises that sound more pro-Israel than pro-Palestinian, and this is unacceptable. And they didn't even intend that, by the way, to be for public consumption. Somebody leaked the letter. So the letter gets leaked, and what happens? The worst characters in Ontario's legal profession, and I have no hesitation in saying that they're a disgrace and an embarrassment to the profession, 24 affluent Zionist lawyers signed a letter in which they basically called for the heads of these students on a platter. Their expulsion, they're being blackballed from the legal profession, no employment opportunities, nothing. And one of the persons who led the charge is this scoundrel, I have no hesitation in saying that either, Howard Levitt, who has a column in the National Post, a weekly column, in which in the Post, he openly called himself, quite apart from the letter he co-signed with these 23 other lawyers, for these students to have their, you know, for their careers to be destroyed. So in that context, the university put out the statement smearing our clients. They were faced with threats of having donations withdrawn. you know, of having members, esteemed members of the bar, refusing to be adjunct professors, you know, to lecture at the university. Their name was being dragged through the mud. And rather than stand up for the students and what is right, they threw the students under the bus. But the judge they chose, Justice McDonald, came to the rescue, and after a months-long investigation, cleared their names. And even then, the university refused to retract its allegation of anti-Semitism.
I want to read a little bit from the advice that the judge gave to TMU administrators, because I think it's quite telling. I mean, there's a few there's many recommendations that all kind of point to exactly what you're saying. I mean, she worded, or they worded a little bit differently there, but here, the lawyers who fueled the backlash against the respondent students displayed the same kind of response for which they have criticized the students, using insensitive and harsh words, rushing to judgment, and not acknowledging opposing viewpoints. They have talked about the importance of civility and respectful dialogue without extending those empathetic sentiments to the students involved. We would encourage them, going forward, to apply their experience and wisdom in ways that support LASL students, whether through mentorship opportunities, placement, or long-term positions. I mean, that's the last thing those students probably want from those lawyers. But that was a real kind of fuck you. You're exactly, what is it? Every accusation is an admission, right?
Yeah. That's, he also chastised, you may have seen this, Jessa, the judge also chastised the university for inflicting hardship on the students. You'd think at that point these people would have the basic decency to retract their scurrilous allocation, but they left it up there for another 16 months.
And I know we're talking university students, and I don't doubt that they might be broke, but they're law students. Like when I said, like, didn't they expect this? But not even of law students who had already been advocates. These were people who put their name to a letter in, I know you say the writing was on the wall, but still the very early days of some of the support that was garnered, right? So these were radical law students that they, so you're trying to teach them a lesson, right? $10 million is nothing to sneeze at for a university. Five of it is help me out. Five is punitive. $5 million is punitive, and $5 million is for...
compensatory. So one is compensation for damages they've sustained, and the other is over and above their compensation. You know, punitive damages are designed to express the court's strong disapproval of the behavior of the defendant. That's what we call punitive damages. So if they get everything they're asking for, it would come to a total judgment of $10 million plus interest.
Plus interest. Do you think this will serve as a deterrent for this administration, even just the launching of the lawsuit? Because we've seen they've already pulled that website down. Maybe we'll get more movement from them. But is this a strong enough deterrent for them and maybe more universities? Because, you know, students were treated awful, especially for looking back at the summer of 2024 with the student encampments and the demonizing a lot of administrations did for students protesting the genocide. Is this the first lawsuit for defamation against a university?
Since the genocide began in October, a Canadian university, I'm not aware of any other defamation lawsuit having been brought by students. There might have been a defamation lawsuit brought by, I'm not sure about this, but it might have been brought by a professor. I know that there was something like that in the United States. There was a professor of a university who brought a defamation lawsuit. There may have been more than one, but I don't believe that there's been any case during this genocide. I can't even think of any before the genocide where students of a university in Canada sued, pro-Palestinian students, sued the university for defamation. And is this a sufficient amount of money to deter them? Certainly it's an amount of money that'll cause them to stand up and take notice. You know, the sad reality is, Jessa, that our universities today operate like for-profit businesses. And I think that has a lot to do with why they threw the students under the bus, because they were looking at it saying, oh, they're going to withdraw donations and we're going to have other, you know, potential donors be deterred from giving to us. And there's a conflict of interest here because these richly paid administrators of the universities in Canada, their compensation, you know, is indirectly impacted by the amount of donations the university receives. So they're looking after their own selves, I would go so far as to say, when they smear students in order to placate wealthy donors.
That's what you think a lot of their motivation lays? Because like that, I think, is a risky move. You cannot say anything, but they wanted to be clear to like distance themselves from these students to begin with. But they took like that extra step. And the students themselves were protesting the neutrality of it all. And they're like, I love how they're like, oh, we're not neutral. We're clearly Zionist. But the one of the things that I thought of when I saw the lawsuit, you know, come across my feed was, okay, someone called them anti-Semitic. What is anti-Semitic? What definition are the courts going to be using to determine? I mean, I know the report cleared them, and we know that defending the freedom for Palestine or fighting a genocide is not anti-Semitic. However, the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism is a big fucking problem. I will link an episode where we kind of really go over exactly why, but you know, most broadly, any criticism of Israel becomes framed as anti-Semitic. Canada adopted this shit in 2019. Now, not legally binding, but we've spoken to movement lawyers who are working cases through the courts, and there's a lot of hate motivation charges and language, and they're not entirely sure what definition of anti-Semitism the courts are using when making decisions. How's that going to play out on your case?
Well, first of all, the judge heard from both Zionist and anti-Zionist members of the Jewish community on this question. And he explicitly states in his report that they raised the Zionist members of the Jewish community who argued that this was anti-Semitic used the IHRA definition. So he's already taken that into account very carefully and gave an opportunity for people who took that position to sit down and talk with him and explain their position. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think we have to investigate this a little further, but it may well be that we will take the position in this litigation that the whole question of whether this is anti-Semitic or not is subject to a legal doctrine called res judicata, or its cousin issue estoppel, which means that there was a full airing of that issue in a judicial or quasi-judicial context. TMU had the opportunity to express its view if it so chose. A judge of competent jurisdiction made the decision. And so it's too late. The issue's been decided. And as a matter of law, it cannot be reopened. So that's a position we may well take in this litigation. But let's suppose the judge rejects that
humor
position.
Humor me, right? Yeah. Pretend you have to deal with the definition.
I welcome the debate over the IHR definition. Bring it on. Bring it on. You want to sit there and explain to a judge why criticism of a state that is committing genocide before the eyes of the world over a two-year period is anti-Semitic? Good luck to you, man. Good luck to you. Wait till we put in the evidence of these baby killers mass murdering Palestinian children with reckless abandon and joy. We'll happily have that debate if we have to have it.
We've done a lot of episodes on the lawfare launched against the Palestinian Solidarity Movement, right? Like open declarations that they will weaponize our legal system to defend the genocide, provide cover for Canada's complicity, criminalize activists, criminalize Palestinians. Is this your way of taking that same legal system and using it to, you know, defend or deter more attacks? Because quite often we feel like we're on the receiving end of lawfare. So I'll say it's nice to see folks using it for good as well. Do you want to comment on that use of lawfare?
Well, you know, the law is both a sword and a shield. And from my perspective, we're using it as a shield, not as a sword. We are massively out-resourced in this fight. Okay, the amount of money that we have at our disposal, I mean, almost nobody in the Palestinian Solidarity Movement can afford to pay a lawyer to defend themselves. There are people, you know, let's take the case of this. I don't know if you followed this crazy lunatic Zionist, Dalia Kurtz, who is suing Eve Engler and Roger Waters.
Okay. Oh, she's suing him now. We know that she's, you know, sicked the Montreal police on him. Yeah.
And then the charges that they filed against Eve after they threw him in the Hoosegower for 5 days for no justification whatsoever. It's outrageous. They dropped the charges against him that relate to his condemnations of Dalia Kurtz. But she then went out. She hired another scoundrel, let me say, Neil Oberman, who ran for the Conservative Party in the last election in Anthony Housefather's rioting and lost. One of the craziest Zionists in the Canadian legal profession.
Zionist versus Zionist. Ooh, what a battle. Yeah,
exactly. He had the audacity to claim that Anthony Housefather was, you know, insufficiently devoted to Israel and that the Liberal Party had a Hamas wing. That's what he said. The Liberal Party had a Hamas wing. Just crazy stuff. Anyways, this guy is now representing Dalia Kurtz in a lawsuit against Roger Waters and Eve Engler. For defamation. Now, I don't know what his arrangement is with her, but I would be very surprised if Neil Oberman is doing that for free. He certainly hasn't come out and said, to my knowledge, that he's doing it pro bono. Somebody's paying him. And there's another law firm called Diamond and Diamond, which is running around the country filing class action lawsuits against universities.
I've heard the commercials.
Yes, yeah. And by the way, these guys are like, again, I've had it with the legal profession in Canada, so I'm not pulling any punches anymore.
Clearly.
Let me just say, Jessa, that all my comments on the legal profession during this broadcast, I should have said at the outset, are on my own behalf. I'm not speaking on behalf of my clients, okay?
Any of them.
They may or may not agree with me. I'm not telling you they don't agree with me. I'm not telling you they do agree with me. I'm just saying I haven't sought their authorization to say these things. So I'm expressing my personal opinion here, okay? Diamond and Diamond are a bunch of ambulance chasers. I knew them from when I was doing class actions law. They do not have a good reputation. They have a very bad reputation. I really doubt that they're doing that pro bono. They're running around the country filing class actions against universities, making these scurrilous allegations that they've created an unsafe environment for Jewish students. The unsafe environment, to the extent it exists on university campuses today, it's an unsafe environment for those who advocate, including members of the Jewish community, for those who advocate for Palestinians. That's where the real unsafety lies, in my opinion. But in any event, who's paying all these lawyers? And I can give you plenty of other examples where there is litigation. So they are waging lawfare against us. And whenever we can, and we have to be strategic about it because our resources are so much more limited, we fight back and use the law as a shield. And that's the way we view this litigation. We're defending the reputations and honor of these students.
Well, you say, you know, you have to be careful with your resources, because if you sued everybody that called a Palestinian solidarity activist anti-Semitic, you would be a very busy lawyer. You would need a lot more friends working pro bono. So I guess, are we hoping that this isn't just a deterrent for TMU, that, you know, when we do strategically strike back and loud enough and hopefully successfully enough, that it will quell some of these attacks? Not even just the online ones, but perhaps the return lawsuits and make them question their lawfare? Or, you know, do they have blinders on as well and they're just plowing straight ahead no matter what?
No, I think this litigation is an earthquake in the academic community in Canada. I have no evidence to back that up, by the way. Okay, but just I'm just going here on my own gut.
We're going to manifest it then.
We'll see, but I'm going here on my own gut instincts about, you know, based upon my interaction with, you know, people in the academic community and my sense of what they, you know, how what their calculus is in situations such as this. If they get a bad precedent in this case, if the court actually rules in favor of our clients, even if there's a preliminary determination, they're going to be extremely worried about the floodgates having been opened up, and that other students who've been silent, who haven't had the wherewithal to come forward, will actually then begin to vindicate their rights, and they're going to just be completely inundated with litigation. I think that that's their concern. I'd be very surprised if it isn't. And so this has the potential to be a game changer. Depending upon how the litigation unfolds, we'll have to see.
Will they want this to go away quietly?
Oh, I would be very surprised if they don't try to make this go away quietly.
Will you let them get away with letting it go away quietly?
Well, that's up to our clients. And that's not a decision. We've had no communication with the university. Like I said, they deleted this scurrilous statement without even notifying us. So I have no idea, you know, what litigation posture they could come to us. It's possible to come to us very quickly and say, we want to get rid of this thing. It's possible to fight us tooth and nail to the bitter end. It's possible that we'll have to, you know, mix it up for a couple of years and then there'll be a settlement. But I wouldn't be surprised if they try to get rid of it quickly. You know, and I want to say one other thing from personal experience, Jessa, and that is that I myself had to sue B'nai B'rith for calling me a supporter of terrorism. And that litigation was settled. I'm limited by the terms of settlement in terms of what I can say of the settlement, but they basically retracted what they said about me, and there was a monetary payment from them, from their insurer to me. And since then, I have not been smeared by a major pro-Israel lobby group. I can't think of one time, not one occasion. That was 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago. And I used to get, you know, weekly smears directed at me by the major pro-Israel lobby groups. And now it's zip. So I think that they, you know, they realized they were dealing with somebody who is prepared to vindicate his rights in the court of law. And I think that that's something that may well happen here in the case of TMU and the universities in general.
Well, I hope specifically the academic community is paying attention, you know, whether it goes away now or not, however it unfolds, it's still going to set a precedent, right? That people fought back and forced a response when that was something a lot of the universities refused to give, right? They refused to disclose, they refused to really give these student protesters any kind of legitimacy, even though, you know, they even tried to pretend they were coming from off campus and all of that. So, you know, we know that the students aren't done mobilizing within those spaces. So anything that we can do to protect them from future attacks, from universities just or administrators going unhinged statements and, you know, sicking the police on them and whatnot, for, you know, making unsafe spaces. So, you know, yeah, no matter how the dust settles, Dimitri, it'll have an impact. Yeah. So you might not have evidence, but, you know, surely it's going to have an impact. Yeah. Santiago, I see you unmuted yourself, brother. Join the conversation.
So you mentioned attacks, and, you know, Dimitri, you were talking about like unsafe environment on campus. It has to be mentioned that like just a couple weeks ago, there was that incident at TMU where a security guard was body slamming a young Palestinian protester who was taking place in a protest. They pinned them on the ground and dragged them out. An incredibly excessive use of force for what was going on there. Right. So it's not like when we talk about like an unsafe environment on campus, it's entirely being created against resorting to physical violence at this point against the pro-Palestinian students.
Yeah. And if you remember back when they started dismantling these encampments, there was also a considerable amount of brutality used by the police. I think it was at the University of Calgary. I'm pretty sure it was Calgary. To dismantle that encampment, just gratuitous violence. Nobody was seriously injured, as I recall, but they were beating people up, you know. And now you have vigilante groups roaming, you know, Zionist vigilantes roaming some of the university campuses in this country. You know, we were involved in a case involving York University a few years ago, where we persuaded, with considerable effort, the university to ban Mayor Weinstein, you know, the head of the former Canadian branch of the Jewish Defense League. That took a lot of work for him to be banned. But the fact that he was banned was an implicit acknowledgement that he was a threat to the students on campus.
And he used to show up like a thug to all of our protests at York with other, you know, JDL. They would wear their insignia. They would just stand. They blocked us in the lunch area, you know, like the student center where you eat, they actually blocked the doors with those thugs one time and sealed the university. It took Dimitri doing what he did. They didn't even see that part as a threat. So thank you for that. Thank you very much for that. Santiago brings up a good point, like that violence and the violence that you described, Dimitri. It's statements like the one that you are challenging that pave way for that, right? Which frame anything Palestinian as inherently violent and dangerous. And so, you know, putting a lid on that will certainly assist in how universities start approaching, in general, Palestinian protests, right? Because they're going to continue. We're coming up on the anniversary, 2-year anniversary, and the work is clearly not done. So, yeah, like, I'm sure there's a few more. There were injuries at the University of Calgary, by the way. We had Jeremy Appel on to talk about that. There was 2 injuries. I think one person was sent to hospital, but there's a lot of administrators out there or professors or people of power that have labeled students wrongfully. So, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing those floodgates open. I'm sure you are.
Yeah. Well, by the way, we have a big motion coming up in another case, which I just want to alert your audience to. And that is last year, 7 of us from across the country, 7 lawyers brought a case against the Canadian government alleging that the Canadian government has violated a genocide convention. So that was in November. So the Attorney General has filed a motion to dismiss our case, claiming that we are raising... In essence, they're claiming that we are raising political questions that are beyond the competence of courts to decide. So this is a doctrine, they call it the political question doctrine, which has been used to knock out similar litigation in the United States and Britain. So the entire litigation is at stake, and we're going to be arguing that motion in Ottawa on November 27th. Yeah.
Folks will have to stay tuned to your pages to kind of get those kind of updates. Is there ways they can apply pressure before that?
Well, to continue doing what you're doing. I mean, and, you know, tell the Canadian government that you are fed up with its complicity in this genocide and demand concrete action. Above all, a legal prohibition backed up by criminal penalties on the transfer of military equipment to Israel and the purchase of military equipment from Israel. That should be a no-brainer. And whatever the government's telling you, they haven't done that. They continue shipping weapons to Israel. That should be the number one priority of this Palestinian solidarity movement in this country. And more broadly, economic sanctions, you know, the rupture of diplomatic relations, suspension of the Canada-Israel free trade agreement. Demand concrete action by your government, because so far it's just nothing but hot air.
In this episode of Palestine Debrief, I speak with Paul Fauteux, a lawyer and an advocate specializing in international law. Paul is also a former diplomat and has served as Director General in several federal departments, including Environment Canada and Indigenous and Northern Affairs. Paul shares a bizarre and rather troubling incident that he has recently experienced. His position as a sports mediator was not renewed, citing lack of impartiality for sending the CDPQ 2 open letters urging them to divest from Israel. Here's Paul sharing what happened and reflecting on his experience.
And so when I came back, I decided that I had been a passive ally of the Palestinian cause for long enough, and it was time to get active. So I hooked up with Karen Rodman of Just Peace Advocates, and it was Karen who brought to my attention the fact that the Caisse de dépôt et placement du Québec, which manages public Quebec pension plans, which is in fact the second largest pension plan manager in Canada, had $14 billion worth of investments in companies that operated in the illegal Israeli settlements. Now, the illegal Israeli settlements are not just illegal in the West Bank. They are war crimes. They are prohibited by the 1949 Geneva Convention on the Protection of Civilians in Times of War. So I thought this was shocking, and that's where I decided to channel my efforts. And I initially wrote a letter calling on the CDPQ to respect international law and to cease to be complicit with Israeli war crimes by investing in companies that were complicit with the Israeli war crime that constituted by the illegal Israeli settlements. And so my friend Georges, who is my professor of international law, as I mentioned, signed on, as did a number of other very highly respected lawyers from around the world. At that time, this was in November of 23. So in the months following the Hamas attacks on the southern Israel communities, no Quebec international lawyers wanted to sign on. This was way too touchy, and we can't take sides between belligerents. So I was the only Quebec lawyer, along with my international friends, to call on the CDPQ to end its complicity with Israeli war crimes. So that's how it started.
During that all this time, you were employed as a sports mediator. That's, I think, also an interesting element.
Yes, that's another aspect of the story. So I became employed as a sports mediator in 2021. Yes. So after 30 years in government, the first 20 with foreign affairs, and then heading the Climate Change Bureau and Environment Canada, and subsequently the Reserve Lands Directorate in Indian Affairs, retired from government and began a new career as a mediator. And after a number of years practicing mediation, I got a gig as a sports mediator with a federally created and funded independent organization called the Center for Sport Dispute Resolution of Canada. So after the first 4 years, my mandate was coming to an end, and there was a call to express interest in renewing my mandate. So I wrote another nice letter saying, hey, this is what I've been doing for you over the last 4 years. In addition to my 4 years of experience as a sports mediator, I had all these qualifications to be hired by the SDRC as an arbitrator in sports matters as well. So I put in my bid to be renewed as a mediator and to get a new mandate as an arbitrator. So a few months later, I get a form letter saying, oh, sorry, we got many great candidacies and you were not successful. So I was really surprised. So I called up the DG and said, could I have a bit of feedback? You know, what happened? Why did the selection committee decide not to retain my candidacy? And she was very candid. And she said, well, look, they thought your performance over the last 4 years was perfect, you know, beyond reproach. All the feedback was great. But they did an internet search and they saw that you wrote not one, but two letters, because after the November 23 letter I mentioned, the CDPQ CEO, Charles Lemont, appeared before the Public Finance Committee of the National Assembly of Quebec, because the CDPQ has one shareholder, right? It's the government of Quebec. So every year he has to go and basically explain himself and respond to questions from members of the National Assembly. And he got some questions on these investments in the illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestine territory. And he gave a whole bunch of bullshit excuses. So I wrote a reply and got my six world-renowned experts in public international law to say why his excuses did not hold water legally and maintaining the call we had issued in November 2023 to divest and to put in place a transparent process to ensure future investments by the CDPQ would not run into these basic violations of international law and international human rights law.
So, I'm sorry, when was that?
That was in May of 24.
May 24.
And so the selection committee had taken note of these two letters and decided that, well, he's not neutral. We can't hire him as a mediator. We need mediators to be neutral. And I was stunned. So after I picked up my jaw, I said, hold on. I didn't write these letters alone. I wrote them and co-signed them. I wrote them, but had them co-signed by six world-class experts in international law. And the fact that with these experts, I was calling on the CDPQ to respect international law has nothing to do with my capacity to be neutral as a sports mediator and a sports arbitrator. And therefore, I do not accept that this is a legitimate decision. That was the end of the conversation. And then I thought about it and did a bit of research and realized that it was not only illegitimate, it was illegal. This was a violation of my right to equality in the exercise of my freedom of expression, as recognized by the Quebec Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So I wrote a complaint to the Quebec Commission of Rights and Freedoms, Commission des droits et libertés de la personne, and I didn't file it. I sent it to the DG of the Support Dispute Resolution Center of Canada, and this would have been in March. And under cover of an email saying, look, I've thought about it. You recall, this is what you said. This is what I said when we had the debrief over the phone. I've come to the conclusion that this decision is not only illegitimate, but illegal. And here's why. Read the attached draft complaint. And I'm sending it to you in draft before filing it, both out of courtesy and because I hope that once you read it, you might come to your senses and realize that you're violating my freedom of expression and you didn't really mean to do that. And so let's fix this problem. Let's settle the dispute. So then several months went by. Well, oh, there's no response. And then, oh, we have to talk to our lawyer. And our lawyer made recommendations. So now we have to go to our board. So then I said, well, please give the following message from me to the board. I'm sure this was a good faith mistake and, you know, you didn't really intend to violate my right to equality in the exercise of my freedom of expression. So, you know, let's settle the matter. And then it took a long time to get a response from the board. And finally, on May 5th, the answer from the board was, no, we don't want to negotiate our decision to not renew your mandate as a mediator and not give you a new the mandate that you asked for as an arbitrator. So I thought about it some more, did some consultations, and filed my complaint last week. And I amended my draft complaint to reflect all of these subsequent exchanges to make clear that the violation of my right to equality in the exercise of my freedom of speech is in fact intentional. They do intend to prevent me from speaking freely, and they do intend to penalize me by removing my my employment with them. And so that justifies punitive damages under the Quebec Charter of Rights and Freedom. So it's just been filed. I haven't yet had a response from the commission, but I'll be following up with them shortly.
And all you did is you sent two letters to the CDPQ.
Had them published in Le Devoir. These were public letters. Yeah,
yeah, they're open letters.
Open letters published in Le Devoir. Yeah.
Signed by renowned international human rights lawyers across the world, I assume.
Yes, that's right.
The six of them.
Including three former special rapporteurs of the United Nations on the situation of human rights in the territory occupied by Israel since 1967.
Can you mention their names?
Oh, sure. So, well, Georges Abissab, as I mentioned earlier, was my Egyptian professor and friend. The three former UN special rapporteurs were Michael Link, Dick Falk, and John Dugard. And in addition, actually, there was another Quebecois who signed on, but he's not living in Quebec. He is Bill Chabas, and Bill kind of shuttles between Paris and London. He literally wrote the book on genocide, and he is responsible for the genocide part of the UN Audiovisual Library of International Law. So he's a world-renowned expert, not just in international law, but specifically on genocide.
Okay, and the request is the content of the open letter, two open letters, were about divestment or what specifically?
Yes, exactly. So there were two companies that were singled out in particular because the case invests in dozens of companies which operate in the illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territory. But we drew attention in particular to two of them. One is WSP. an engineering firm based in Montreal that is responsible, that is the maître d'œuvre or coordinator of the Jerusalem Light Rail Transit System, the purpose of which, of course, is to entrench illegally annexed East Jerusalem into the territory of Israel, right? And Alstom, which is a French company that bought Bombardier Rail and that is responsible for the Tel Aviv to Jerusalem rail link, which crosses into the occupied Palestinian territory and two parts of its rails, and basically is, you know, on illegally expropriated Palestinian land.
Okay.
Thereby assisting in the illegal occupation of the Palestinian territory. And this is an important and recent international legal development, because when I published my two letters in November 23 and May 24, we did not yet have the benefit of the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice that was rendered in July 24, which made clear that the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory since 1967 is illegal, has no basis under international law. And the only legal thing that Israel can do in the occupied Palestinian territory is leave and pay compensation for all the damage done.
I think the deadline for that is September, no? 2025. It's September 17, maybe, or 18?
I thought it was July. I don't have it.
No, the deadline. They have to do it by.
Oh, yes, exactly. Yeah. And the deadline was not set by the court, but by the General Assembly. So the General Assembly received the advisory, because that's how ICJ advisory opinions work, right? They generally are a request from the General Assembly. Please enlighten us on the state of international law on this subject. And the General Assembly, having receive the advisory opinion, set a deadline for evacuation by Israel of the occupied Palestinian territory. Okay. Not that we expect that to happen, but of course, an important
they have 6 days.
List, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they also, so they terminated your employment after these two letters, citing your impartial. You can't be impartial.
You can't be neutral, right?
You can't be neutral.
If you're not neutral, then you're partial. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think this is amongst a lot of stories across Canada and the world, where people have expressed their solidarity with the Palestinian cause and the illegality of the occupation, had to pay the price on losing their employment or their
doctorate. And as you say, this is happening in Canada and the world. And one of the attachments to the email I sent to the DG of the Sport Dispute Resolution Center of Canada, along with my draft complaint seeking an amicable settlement, one of the attachments was a report in which I was heavily involved by CLARE, Canadian Lawyers for International Human Rights, which was sent in 2024 to the special rapporteurs, and there are several, on freedom of opinion, freedom of expression, freedom of peaceful assembly, and freedom of peace of association of both the UN and the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, to which, of course, Canada is a party. And this report to the special rapporteurs on these fundamental freedoms was precisely about the repression of freedom of expression, opinion, assembly, association in Canada by people who, as you said, expressed solidarity with the Palestinian people. And the other report was a report by the Secretary General of the United Nations to the General Assembly on this same theme of repression of freedom of speech in the particular context of Gaza.
And let's talk slightly about the importance of the CDPQ for the, because I remember you mentioned that CDPQ was the baby of the silent revolution along with Hydro-Québec.
Revolution of the early 1960s, brought about by the election of the Liberal Party led by Jean Lesage, which brought to an end decades of political dominance of the Quebec government by the Conservative Party that was at that time called L'Union Nationale. So yes, the CDPQ was a creation of Jacques Parizeau, who was an advisor to the Lesage government in the early 60s. And the idea was, well, the French Canadians of Quebec are the dominated and colonized minority. The dominated and colonized majority, right? Mm-hmm. And they are dominated and colonized by the English-speaking minority that ever since the British conquest of New France in 1760 has been in control of the Quebec economy. So one of the tools created by the Lesage government in what was called the Quiet Revolution, or La Révolution Tranquille en français, the Tranquil Revolution, was the creation of Hydro-Québec. Because at that time, all electricity in Quebec was produced by private companies that were either controlled by English-speaking Québécois or Canadians or Americans. And so the Quebec government nationalized all these hydroelectric companies to create Hydro-Québec. So the Caisse de dépôt et de placement was created about the same time and in the same spirit of creating significantly important tools of economic development that would help to bring the French-Canadian majority of Quebec out of economic dominance.
Yeah, and of course, the CDPQ is amongst what's called the Maple Eight, which is the eighth largest investment funds of Canada, which all of which are invested in the occupation and apartheid.
That's right, and it is second in size in public pension fund managers only to the federal Canadian Public Service Pension Plan, which itself, as you say, is also invested in companies that operate in the illegal Israeli settlements.
I think there was a statistic that, you know, the Maple Eight makes, I think, roughly 60 or 65% of Canadians either directly or indirectly complicit in the funding of the genocide, because, you know, it holds the pension funds and the private investments of most public sector Canadians. What's interesting is that the CDPQ was the only investment fund in Canada that was mentioned by Francesca Albanese's latest report.
That's correct. Yes. The economy of genocide. Business enterprises, which are the business enterprises that are profiting not only from Israeli apartheid as they have been for a very long time, but from the current genocide in Gaza.
Yeah. And I think the latest article, if I'm not mistaken, I read, published a couple of weeks ago, it was in French, indicated that there is some sort of silent divestment happening. Have you come across?
Yes, there was an article to that effect, and it was actually followed by a more recent article, which was specific to WSP. So, as I mentioned, WSP is the Montreal-based engineering firm that is in charge of the Jerusalem Light Rail Transit project. They've closed their office in Israel very recently, and this was published in an Israeli paper called Globe. So you might want to look into that. So I don't know that that's silent divestment. It's publicly reported. And I think it's a step in the right direction. So if WSP is feeling the heat and feeling that maybe it's not such a good idea to continue to be complicit in war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide, perhaps Alstom will follow suit and perhaps the CDPQ will follow suit. But time will tell.
Yeah, of course, by silent, I mean that the CDPQ themselves did not publicly announce, this is what we're doing, this is our plan.
That's right.
It's like sort of, let's just brush off the dust, you know, and get on as if nothing happened. Because I think to date, and even as far back, I think, of June 2025, when Francesca's report was published, they issued a statement.
Press release like, saying, no, this is not.
Downplaying the
And in fact, it was in response to that CDPQ statement that I took the pen once again to write a third letter, open letter addressed to the CDPQ. And this time The list of signatories, as I mentioned, grew from 6 or 7 to 15 or 16. Among them, a number of Quebec-based, well-regarded professors of international law. And it was in direct response to this statement and concluded with by drawing attention to the obvious double standard that the CDPQ is applying in its selective application of its own human rights policy and its alleged compliance with international law, because what they need to do in the occupied Palestinian territory isn't hard, and they've already done it elsewhere. On 22 February 2022, on the day Russian tanks rolled into Ukraine, CDPQ immediately announced it was divesting from Russia, because we can't invest in a country that's, you know, committing the crime of aggression under international law. So why the double standard? If you can do it for Russia, and you did do it for Russia, and you didn't wait for months and years of open letters and pressure, you did it on the day of the invasion, why can't you do it for the occupied Palestinian territory?
That's what's called the Palestinian exception. So why are you so heavily invested in this? I think you paid a very good price on it. You lost your employment over it, and you're still persistent on the path of it. So what's
Yes, I am persistent on the path of it, and in fact, the fact that I was penalized in terms of employment is not so important for me. You know, I'm 70 years old. I'm a retired public servant. You know, I was not counting on this to pay my bills and put food on the table. But I, in fact, consider it an honor to have been the victim of employment discrimination for speaking out in favor of peace and justice for the Palestinian people. And I relish the opportunity to bring this to the attention of the Quebec Commission of Rights and Freedoms, not in my own personal interest, but, you know, as an example of the kind of repression of freedom of expression that must be opposed and that must be halted. In terms of why do I persist and why do I think this is so important, about 15 years ago, after I retired from the Public Service of Canada, this would have been in 2010, I went to a conference where I heard Stephen Lewis, the former, he was actually Ambassador of Canada to the United Nations when I joined Foreign Affairs in 1980, and he has a distinguished career as a leader of the Ontario New Democratic Party. And he's a socialist like me. And the phrase that stuck in my mind from that speech was, "There is no better use for a human life than to pick a small piece of injustice and try to make it better."
That's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Before we end the show today, I wanted to let you know that Under the Olive Tree will be taking a break for a couple of months. During this break, other Palestine-related news and reports will be playing instead. Same day, same hour, so make sure to tune in as usual until we are back on air. You can also, during that time, listen to many of our previous episodes. You can find them on CQUT's website at cqut.ca and click on the name of the show to see the archive. You can also find the link to that archive on CFRC's website at cfrc.ca. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Yeah.
When traffic's a nightmare. When the workplace is hectic. When your boss calls you in for a meeting. When nature isn't on your side.